In your overview book, it's on page, let's see, page one, you'll see that Gauri Janprabhu has compiled quotations by Srila Prabhupada from different of his purports in Bhagavad Gita, in which he's describing the basic messages and the basic ideas contained in the different chapters. That's page one. So I'll just read. The quotation B about chapter 2. Srila Prabhupada writes, this is from the purport of chapter 2, verse 72. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur has summarized the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita as being the contents for the whole text. In Bhagavad Gita, the subject matters are Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. In the second chapter, Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga have been clearly discussed, and a glimpse of Bhakti Yoga has also been given as the contents for the complete text. So this chapter is entitled Contents of the Gita Summarized, and as we go through it, if you're very attentive, you'll see how actually basically all the subjects which are discussed in Bhagavad Gita, they do make an appearance in this chapter, even though generally it's in a very brief form. And even for that matter, practically every subject which is discussed in all the Vedic scriptures is referred to here in chapter 2 very briefly. Anyway, when we get to the end of the chapter, I'll just review the various subjects that are presented in it. But if you're attentive as we go through, you'll see how so many subjects come up very briefly. The attendance sheet is somewhere out there amongst you. Do please keep passing it around till everyone has marked themselves present. So there are five sections in chapter 2. The first one is from verse 1 to verse 10. Of course, we've already discussed certain of the verses in this section. The section is dealing with Arjuna's doubts, which we have discussed, and Krishna preparing to instruct Arjuna. So apparently, Dhritarashtra, when he heard from Sanjaya that Arjuna was so bewildered and so emotionally disturbed and throwing down his bow and everything, then Dhritarashtra, he was very happy. He thought, this is very nice. We are bound to win despite everything. But then, when Sanjaya spoke this verse 1 of chapter 2, Dhritarashtra, his little bubble of happiness was burst, because Sanjay uses the word, the name, Madhusudana for Krishna. Madhusudana is quite a well-known name of the Supreme Lord. It means he who killed the Madhu demon. Madhu demon was a big demon who appeared sometime earlier on in the universe. And Krishna appeared and killed that Madhu demon. I think it was Madhu and Kaitav. He killed at more or less the same time. They were big, big demons. So, the fact that Sanjay uses this name, Madhusudana, indicates that Krishna is going to kill these doubts of Arjuna. These doubts are like demons. So Krishna is going to kill those doubts in the same way he killed that Madhu demon. And when Arjuna is free from those doubts, then he'll fight very nicely. And it's very likely he'll win. In verse 2, you can see Krishna expresses his feelings about the doubts of Arjuna. Krishna doesn't appreciate them very much. He says, Anarya Jushtam. Anarya. You're speaking all these doubts. But these types of ideas, these types of ideas are embraced by people who are Anarya. Anarya basically means not really up to the proper standard to be considered human beings. The Aryans, Aryan, the word Aryan basically means a person who understands the real values of life, real values in life. In other words, a qualified human being. But Anarya means a person who doesn't understand the value of the human form of life and doesn't utilize the human form of life properly. So strictly speaking, such a person wouldn't really be classified as a proper human being. So this is a big insult for Arjuna. Big insult. Because he's meant to be one of the leaders of humanity, actually. But Krishna's saying, you're Anarya. So Krishna, he doesn't play around at all with Arjuna. He comes right to the point in no uncertain terms whatsoever. He doesn't sentimentally tell him that, well, you know, I think you've spoken very nicely and I appreciate your feelings and it's very nice, but, you know, maybe we can come up with a slightly better idea. No, he just tells him, look, you are Anarya. You are practically not speaking like someone who's not even a human. You're a fool. So quite a cutting response from Krishna. But it's important to note that even, like we mentioned yesterday, even though in certain regards these doubts of Arjuna, some of them may sound quite nice, but Krishna doesn't appreciate them at all. Not at all. They shouldn't be taken seriously. Verse 3, he calls him impotent. Arjuna's a big Kshatriya. So Kshatriyas are generally very potent in all ways, very powerful persons. But Krishna's calling Arjuna impotent, just like a weakling. And he says that these sentiments of yours, they are petty weaknesses. Give up this petty weakness of heart. So this is all very petty, all these ideas of yours. In verse 4, Arjuna tries to counter that in a rather sort of half-hearted way by saying that it's not weakness, but it's generosity. I'm trying to be kind to these people. How can I attack them? They're such great souls. But of course we should understand that a Kshatriya is happy to be attacked because it gives him the chance to fight. Anyway, Arjuna is saying that it's not weakness, it's generosity. I'm trying to be a very broad-minded, nice fellow. Then 5 and 6 we discussed yesterday. We discussed those yesterday under saintliness and fear of sinful reaction. Then in 6, Arjuna's manifesting his indecision. Despite having so many high-sounding ideas, he really isn't convinced. He just doesn't really know what to do. 7 is significant. In verse 7, this is the first mention of spiritual master-disciple relationship, which of course is very important in Krishna consciousness. Krishna goes on later on in the 4th chapter to state very clearly that spiritual master is a necessity in spiritual life. I'll just read a little bit of this purport. Verse 7, I'll read the first paragraph. By nature's own way, the complete system of material activities is a source of perplexity for everyone. In every step there's perplexity, and therefore it behooves one to approach a bona fide spiritual master who can give one proper guidance for executing the purpose of life. All Vedic literatures advise us to approach a bona fide spiritual master to get free from the perplexities of life, which happen without our desire. They're like a forest fire that somehow blazes without being set by anyone. Similarly, the world's situation is such that perplexities of life automatically appear without our wanting such confusion. No one wants fire, and yet it takes place, and we become perplexed. The Vedic wisdom therefore advises that in order to solve the perplexities of life and to understand the science of the solution, one must approach a spiritual master who's in the disciplic succession. A person with a bona fide spiritual master is supposed to know everything. One should not, therefore, remain in material perplexities, but should approach a spiritual master. This is the purport of this verse. It's interesting, Prabhupada says, a person with a bona fide spiritual master is supposed to know everything. I don't know, I'm sure most of you, if maybe all of you have spiritual masters. Don't know if you feel you know everything yet. Perhaps not. Prabhupada was asked once, do you know everything? Because that idea is there. I mean, even here, a disciple is meant to know everything, and spiritual masters quite often described as being all-knowing or something like that. So Prabhupada was asked once, do you know everything? And Srila Prabhupada said, no, I don't know everything, but Krishna does, and he tells me. So, Srila Prabhupada. Anyway, the point is that a person who's properly situated in relationship with the spiritual master, in relationship with Krishna, will never really be in want of knowledge. Will never really be in that position where they just don't know what to do or how to approach a situation. By the grace of the spiritual master and by the grace of Krishna. Then, verse 8 we discussed yesterday. Verse 9, Arjuna basically is now finishing expressing his doubts and his feelings of weakness. Any of you later comers not have one of these overviews? Three of you, is it? There's the two people just behind you also. And the attendance sheet, it's very nice that you're passing it around, but don't hold on to it. It should make its way back here sooner or later. Yeah, so verse 9, Arjuna finishes expressing his doubts. And in verse 10, Krishna prepares to reply. An interesting point in verse 10 is the use of the word in the second line of the Sanskrit, prahasan. Prahasan, it's translated in the word for word as smiling. A more literal translation is like smiling, almost smiling, something along those lines. Not really smiling, but not, you know, not just expressionless, like smiling. So it indicates that Krishna, having previously been in a friendly mood, and Arjuna, he was also in that friendly type of mood, but now the mood is changing. Arjuna is surrendering. Of course, it takes a while for Arjuna to really surrender, but at least he's beginning. And Krishna is observing that, and he's responding to that. So Krishna is becoming more grave, and he's stepping out of that role of friend and into the role of spiritual master or spiritual authority. So that brings us into section B, verses 11 to 30. This is a well-known section. I'm sure you're all familiar with many of the verses in it. It's entitled Gyan. And the basic idea is that the soul is eternal, so why should Arjuna not fight them? Why should he not fight, seeing the soul is eternal? It's not exactly the same as Jnana Yoga. Although that, perhaps we could open the doors a bit. The noise has died down. And the heat is building up. There you go. Open that up. This knowledge here in these 20 or so verses, this knowledge is like the basic knowledge of Jnana Yoga. But here, of course, just the basic elements of knowledge are being presented, not actually the practices of Jnana Yoga as such. So it's Jnana, knowledge of the soul, and seeing the soul is immortal, then why should Arjuna not fight? Why should he worry about the bodies of his friends and relatives? So there are three subsections that jumps around a bit. The first subsection is verse 11 to verse 13, then there's a break, and it goes on from 16 to 25. So 11, Krishna calls Arjuna directly a fool. He says that those who are wise, they don't act like you're acting. So that means you're not wise. You're unwise, or in other words, you're a fool. Krishna's really speaking in a very, very strong way. Verse 12 is an interesting verse. It actually establishes the personal nature of spiritual life. This, the conflict between the impersonalists and the personalists, is not just a recent development in Indian spiritual history. You know, it's not that it just came about with Shankaracharya or anyone like that, but it's always been there. So Krishna here, this is actually the first verse that Krishna speaks in which he's really saying something about the soul, saying something spiritual. So what does he say? That I've existed as an individual, and you have existed, all these kings have existed. We've all existed as individuals, and we'll all continue to exist as individuals. So, has everyone marked themselves present? So Krishna is establishing right here in the very beginning that spiritually we are eternal individuals. And of course he makes the point again in a few other places further on. But it's interesting that it comes up right at this very, very early point. Verse 13, Krishna's saying that, of course we all know this verse, I would assume. One interesting point about this verse is that of all the verses in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, of all the verses in scriptures that we deal with, this verse was lectured on by Srila Prabhupada the second most. There's one other verse in which appears in Bhagavad Gita, which Prabhupada lectured on more than this. But this verse was lectured on more than any other verse in any other scripture other than that one verse. That one verse that Prabhupada lectured on the most was chapter 7, verse 1. In fact, he lectured on that verse twice as frequently as this. There are about 13 or 14 or 12, something like that, recorded lectures of Prabhupada on 2.13. But there's over 20 on chapter 7, verse 1. So it certainly says something about this verse. It's a very important verse. I'm sure you're all familiar with this verse. So Krishna is saying here, well, Arjuna, he was so worried about killing Bhishma, Drona and company. But Krishna here is saying that you won't be killing them. You won't really be killing them because they are the soul, they're eternal. So why worry? You don't need to not fight. You can fight. Then according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, between verse 13 and 14, Arjuna comes up with another doubt. It's also rather petty. According to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, Arjuna says that's okay, but my relationship is with these people while they're in their present bodies now. So if I kill them and they leave these bodies and go away to another lifetime somewhere else, then I'm going to lose their association. And I don't want to lose their association. So therefore I don't want to kill them. But then in reply to that, it's rather an interesting point that Arjuna makes. It's definitely not very spiritually oriented. But in reply to that, Krishna speaks, verse 14, that you have to tolerate these things. These things happen. That's the way life works in this material world. Happiness, distress, heat, cold. So, they're going to die anyway. So what does it really matter if they die now or they die later? You're going to have to tolerate it sooner or later. Of course, verses 14 and 15 are kind of taken out as a little subsection themselves. Verse 15 is important because in verse 15, Krishna establishes what is like practically the most fundamental principle of yoga. Krishna says, the person who's not disturbed by happiness and distress and is steady in both is certainly eligible for liberation. Now, of course, when we speak of yoga, we speak of, there's so many different types of yogas, but they're all processes for achieving liberation. Some are personal, some are impersonal. But the basic idea, which runs through all, at least as far as the goal is concerned, is liberation. And the basic principle in yoga is detachment. Detachment. Detachment is there in bhakti yoga, it's there in karma yoga, jnana yoga, ashtanga yoga. It's like the fundamental principle of any process which can be called yoga. So it's a very important point, and we'll see how it's important as we go further through this chapter. So then from verse 16 to verse 25, going back to the first subsection, basic knowledge of the soul. Again, in verse 16, Krishna, he's giving Arjuna another slap in the face. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the soul there is no there's no change, and for the body, that the body practically doesn't exist. So the seers of the truth know this, but you don't, Arjuna. So that means that you're not a seer of the truth. It means you're an illusion. So it's another little slap in the face. Verses 17 and 18, in these two verses, Krishna establishes that what is this eternal thing, first of all, that he's referred to in verse 16. And then in verse 18, he describes what is this non-existent thing. Verse 17 is describing the imperishable soul. And verse 18, Krishna is talking about the material body. Material body is called non-existent, not exactly in the sense that it really doesn't exist, as Shankaracharya would have us believe. According to Shankaracharya, we don't have bodies. There's only Brahma. And the fact that we appear to have bodies is an illusion. Actually, there are no bodies. There's only Brahman. So, when Krishna says that the body is non-existent, he doesn't mean in that sense. that is basically in the sense that our bodies are constantly changing. Every 7 years all the cells change, apparently. But in the meantime, even from moment to moment, the certain cells are changing, the structure of the body is changing, even though it's very, very slightly. So the body is not existing at any point in like a fixed state. In other words, you could say that your body now and your body at the end of the class are not really the same body. Not exactly the same body. There's actually been a change. So in that sense, these bodies are taken to be or can be looked at as being non-existent. In 19, Krishna is making the point that the soul is neither the doer nor is action done to him. The soul's transcendental to this whole process of doing things and having things done to you. From verse 20 to 25, Krishna's giving like a basic definition of what is the soul. The basic characteristics of the soul, from verse 20 to 25. For the soul there's neither birth nor death at any time. He's not come into being, does not come into being, and will not come into being. He's unborn, eternal, ever-existing and primeval. He's not slain when the body is slain. In between 20 and 21, according to Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, Arjuna comes up with another one of his objections. That objection is that I agree, Arjuna says, I agree that the soul's eternal. I'm not disputing that. But I don't want to be the cause of them changing bodies. Why should I be the cause? But then Krishna replies that you are not going to be able to stop them changing their bodies if you don't fight. So therefore, why not fight? Why not? Anyway, that is there. So from verse 20 to 25, I won't read through all the verses, but Krishna is defining, giving certain definitions or descriptions of certain features of the soul. Then verses 26 to 30, this is the third subsection. The idea is that the soul can't be killed and the body can't be saved, so why not fight? Verse 26, Krishna does an interesting thing. Arjuna has said that, or Krishna is sort of like a checkmate, that's the term that Bhurijan uses. Krishna says, if you think there's a soul, you should fight, because the soul will live on. Fighting or killing won't affect the soul, the real person. And if you think there's no soul, that we're only material bodies, then you should also fight. Because the body, it comes into being, it wasn't existing to start off with, is existing for a while, sooner or later it's going to stop existing. So what does it matter if you stop it existing? It's going to stop existing sooner or later anyway. Krishna is bringing up this point about the soul or the symptoms of life possibly always being born and dying. Of course, the basic idea that Krishna has been presenting is that the soul is eternal. But he's saying here that if you think that there isn't really a soul, but we're just bodies, then you should still fight. The reason he's bringing this up, Prabhupada explains in the purport, is that there's 29 reads, Some look on the soul as amazing. Some describe him as amazing. Some hear of him as amazing. While others, even after hearing about him, can't understand him at all. So Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he says that some look on the soul as amazing. Then he says, some amazing people look on the soul. And some people look on the soul, and that's amazing. So in these three ways, he looks at these statements. Some describe the soul as amazing. Some amazing people describe the soul. And some people describe the soul, and that's amazing. And of course, others, after hearing about the soul, they cannot understand him at all. So these few verses from 26 to 30, they're, of course, it's all related to the idea of the eternal soul. But particularly the point is coming up here, that if you think there is no soul, then still you should fight. And 30 is like a summary of this whole section from 11 to 30. Oh, thank you. Anyone who's here who doesn't have a Bhagavad Gita? And who's awake? Who's not awake? Put up your hand. I think let's just see. We needed four. You need one, that's right. Someone else needs one? Oh well. There's a couple. Looks like we need two more.
Two more?
I think so, yeah. We needed four more yesterday. This is two, so.
Sorry,
okay. You may have heard, just as a minor diversion, that the presiding deity of sleep, some of you will have heard this, Nidra Devi, at the beginning of creation, she complained to Lord Vishnu that I do my duty, you know, very freely and nicely, but there's one problem. That is that I can't do my duty putting people to sleep with the Vaishnavas, with your devotees. Because they're always awake, because they're hearing your glories, hearing and chanting about you. So Lord Vishnu thought and said, all right, I'll give you a benediction. That whenever my devotees are hearing, he said, actually, Srimad Bhagavatam, then you can work on it. I think it includes Bhagavad Gita also. So I think she's doing her duty quite well this morning. So try and stick with it. I mean, we could always turn on a fan if that would help. Or...
is this job? This is really stated in Shastra.
Yes, it's true. And you can see it. The realization is there. Anyway, so verse 30 just sums up this section from 11 to 30. The soul's eternal, can never be killed, so don't be so worried. Don't be in such great anxiety about killing. Then, from 31 to 38, Krishna talks about, Krishna is still encouraging Arjuna to fight, but from a different angle of vision altogether. Really, completely different. Now he's talking about the fact that you're a Kshatriya. And if you don't fight, the basic idea is, if you don't fight, people are going to think very badly of you, and you're going to feel very hurt. In fact, it'll be worse than death. It'll be terrible. Dishonor is worse than death. So, in 31, Krishna makes the point that for you to fight, Arjuna, it's actually a religious duty. For the Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Sudras, if they do their duty properly, even if it's not really for spiritual realization, but if they just do their duty properly, then there won't be any sinful reaction. Not only will there not be any sinful reaction, but simply by doing their duty properly, they'll be elevated to heaven. That is the Vedic system, as established by Krishna, Chaturvani and Mayashista. So, Krishna is saying that it's the best thing for you to do, to fight. And 32, Krishna is saying that when a Kshatriya gets the opportunity to fight without looking for it, it just comes to him, then he's very happy. He feels himself extremely fortunate because the doors of heaven are being opened without him having to make any big effort. So it's the same basic idea. Just do your duty according to Varnashram, and you'll automatically be elevated to the heavenly planets. However, the rest of this section, at least say 33 to 37, Krishna's discussing what will happen if you don't do your duty. Well, first of all, he says, you'll incur sin. This is the first point. If you don't act as a Kshatriya, even if you try and do some other duty very nicely, but because you're not acting as a Kshatriya, you'll incur sin. And then what to speak about your honor? People will speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. So this is kind of, you know, to try and get Arjuna to fight on the basis of his pride and honor. These ideals are not as lofty as the ideals of the eternal spirit soul. You know, it's really coming down to the material platform very much. But if you don't fight, people are going to speak of you very badly. You'll lose your honor. Your good name will be lost. Of course, a devotee isn't really worried about, was not meant to be worried about, his or her good name. But a Kshatriya, at least who's on the material platform, he'll have a definite sense of honor, pride, like that. So Krishna is trying to sort of encourage Arjuna to fight on the basis of that sense of pride. The great generals, previously they all thought of you very highly, but they'll think that you left the battlefield out of fear. As we were saying, Arjuna, he expressed some feeling of compassion. He didn't want to kill the warriors on the other side. But Krishna's saying that a Kshatriya feels very fortunate if he gets into a fight without looking for it. They want to fight. They actually want to fight. So if they hear that, oh, Arjuna was feeling compassionate, he didn't want to hurt you, then it's not that the Kauravas would think that, oh, how nice of him. What a gentleman. No. They'd simply think, oh, he's just a coward. He's just a sissy. Because they are feeling very happy. We can fight now. How wonderful. We can achieve the heavenly kingdom. Or if we win, we'll achieve a kingdom on this planet. So actually they're looking forward to the fight. So either, in 37, Krishna is saying, either you'll be killed on the battlefield and attain the heavenly planets, which means you win. You're winning in a sense. Or else you'll win in the battle and you'll win an earthly kingdom, which means you win. So it's like if you lose you win, and if you win you win. You can't miss. Whereas Arjuna was saying that if I win I lose, and if I lose then I lose. So Krishna is just turning the whole thing around. Arjuna was thinking that if I win, there's going to be no one to enjoy the kingdom with. So I don't want to win. But if I lose, then, you know, I'll probably be dead. Or I'll just lose. So if I lose, I lose. So if I win, I lose. And if I lose, I lose. But Krishna is saying that if you lose, you win. And if you win, you win. So, how can we go wrong? Then in verse 38, Krishna makes an interesting statement. Tomorrow we're going to go into the subject of the yoga ladder. In fact, tonight we want you to read the yoga ladder, the description of the yoga ladder, which is page 55. So there are different stages in the yoga ladder, and one of them is called Sakam Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga means you do your duty according to the nature of your body and your psychology. You do it, but in a detached spirit. As we mentioned, that detachment is like the fundamental principle of yoga. So you do your duty, but in a detached spirit. So it's not just karma, it's karma yoga. But you're still attached. You're still attached materially. So it's sakam, kam, K-A-M-A, sakam karma yoga. Kam, K-A-M-A, means material desire, and sa means with. You do your duty for spiritual elevation, so it's karma yoga, not just karma, but you still have material desire. You're still attached to the activity itself, as opposed to nishkam karma yoga, where you do your duty for elevation in a detached spirit, but you have no attachment whatsoever. So here Krishna says, fight for the sake of fighting. So you fight with attachment to the fighting. So it's sakam. It's with material attachment. But you try and cultivate, try not to consider happiness, distress, loss or gain, victory or defeat. Try and cultivate this higher attitude. But of course, just because you're just beginning this process now, you're still attached. So fight for the sake of fighting. It comes naturally to you. But try and cultivate this mood of detachment. Okay. Sakam Karma Yoga. S-A-K-A-M-A. Kam means desire or lust. So it's sakam karma yoga. Karma yoga, doing your duty according to your physical and psychological nature, for elevation, trying to cultivate detachment, but you are still attached. You're not completely free of attachment. So in the case of a kshatriya, he would fight, as Krishna is saying, fight for the sake of fighting. Whereas in nishkam karma yoga, then he fights, but he's not fighting for the sake of fighting. He's fighting simply on the principle of duty. If he had another duty, he'd do that. But in on the level of sakam, he's fighting because he likes fighting. But he's trying to cultivate detachment at the same time. It's coming from the Acharyas. Yeah. And if you read page 55, and I think it goes over to page 56, what we've asked you to read tonight, the yoga ladder, it describes these things very clearly. So now starting with verse 39, it's the fourth section, verse 39 to 53. It's a description mainly of nishkam karma yoga. Doing your duty, in the case of Arjuna that means fighting, for spiritual elevation, but free from attachment. It's also called Buddhi Yoga. Buddhi Yoga, it's a term, you'll see if you go through all these verses from 39 onwards, you'll see that Krishna uses the term Buddhi Yoga again and again to describe the particular process he's going to describe here. Buddhi, of course, means intelligence. Buddhi yoga, it's sort of like, more like an umbrella term because it particularly refers to Nishkam Karma Yoga, but it also applies to, can be applied to Bhakti Yoga. Any of you know a very famous verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna refers to what is definitely pure devotional service as Buddhi Yoga? Very good, yeah. Chapter 10, verse 10. Tesham satata yuktanam bhajatam priti purvakam. Priti means love, or at least very strong affection, somewhere between bhava and prema, or even prema as such. Dadami buddhi yogantam. So, of course, it's a fact, and we'll discuss it when we get to that point, that what is really buddhi yoga doesn't completely include at least the higher levels of bhakti yoga. But still the term is used sort of as like an umbrella term to describe karma yoga and bhakti yoga at least up to a certain point. So, nishkam karma yoga then, or buddhi yoga. So in verse 39, Krishna sets the scene by saying that I've given you spiritual knowledge, jnana, now. And I've encouraged the idea of fighting on the basis of the knowledge. But it's not that that knowledge would automatically encourage you to fight. It's not that that knowledge of the soul, if Krishna just gave Arjuna knowledge of the soul, and there was no reference to fighting in some completely different scenario altogether. It's not that after Arjuna heard all this knowledge about the soul in that setting, that Arjuna would then think that, oh yes, I might as well go and fight and kill people. No. It was just that that knowledge of the soul was being sort of dovetailed to justify that, you know, at least there's nothing wrong with killing in this situation. But it's not that that killing would, or that fighting would naturally follow as like a function of that knowledge. But this Buddhi yoga means it's the same knowledge of the soul, but it includes that you must act. So therefore it naturally follows in the context of karma yoga or buddhi yoga. It naturally follows that Arjuna would conclude that, oh yes, so I must fight. So this buddhi yoga or nishkam karma yoga, it's like a combination of jnana, knowledge of the soul, and duty. That's really what it is. It's not just duty. In 31 to 38, Krishna discusses duty. Just because you're a kshatriya, fight. And of course from 11 to 30, it's all knowledge of the soul. But this is a combination of the two. Your duty according to your material nature, so that means karma, but then the spiritual knowledge, so it's not just karma, but it's karma yoga. And you should try and do it without any personal desire, detached. Then it's nishkam karma yoga. I hope this doesn't sound too complicated. I know it's slightly complicated, I don't think it's too complicated really. But these first chapters are a little bit like that. It's a little complicated. The intricacies of karma, jnana, and then later on ashtanga and meditation. It's a little complicated. So anyway, this is the idea of nishkam karma yoga or buddhi yoga. Do your duty in spiritual knowledge, in a mood of detachment. And we'll see later on, Krishna stresses that you have to do your duty. If you don't do your duty, then your body and mind, if you're not free from their influence, your body and mind are going to force you to act. So So you may try to simply be a jnani. Just sit there and meditate or be fixed in your knowledge. But if you don't engage your body and your mind, according in whatever way comes naturally to them, if you don't do that, you're going to find yourself being forced to act. And so you'll lose your detached position, your philosophical position, like that. So being able to act means that your body and your mind feel comfortable. You're acting, letting your body and mind act as they want. In Arjuna's case, being a kshatriya is just what comes naturally to him. But you're doing it in a spiritual context. So in the end, you get liberation. So it's a very nice process. And in verse 40, probably you all know verse 40, Krishna glorifies this process. It's such a nice process. There's no loss, no diminution. Even if you just make a little advancement, you get saved from the mahatobhaya, the greatest type of fear. Such a nice process. Very easy to perform, but it's very pure and spiritual. Verse 41, of course, is also a very important verse. It describes the essential characteristic that a person must have if they're going to really make a success in yoga. Those who are on this path are resolute in purpose and their aim is one. So if you want to be successful in yoga, you have to be like this. Or else, Krishna says, the intelligence of those who are irresolute is many-branched. You have to be fixed in yoga. Probably you know that when Prabhupada read this verse and the commentary by Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura, Prabhupada's own words were that he felt very struck by it, particularly by the commentary of Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura. Very struck. And it had quite a deep influence in his life, actually, from that point on. I don't know if you've been through our overview completely yet, but we're very fortunate that on the very last page there are some quotations from that commentary of Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura. So I'll just read that. Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura says, "The best kind of intelligence I can have is intelligence used in the service of Krishna. That intelligence is defined as fixed. Intelligence is fixed when it is intent upon my spiritual master's instructions, such as chanting the names of Krishna, remembering his activities, and performing service to his lotus feet. His instructions are my sadhana and my life, both in the beginning stages of bhakti as well as in bhakti's perfectional stage. I desire only to follow his instructions. I accept nothing else as my life's work, even in dreams. Whether I'm happy or distressed, whether the material world remains or is destroyed, I do not care. There's no loss for me. I simply must carry out the orders of my spiritual master. Fixedness upon his orders is determined intelligence in devotional service." So he's defining what is determined intelligence in devotional service. It means to be fixed on the orders of the spiritual master. And only by being fixed in his orders is such determined intelligence possible. So that's directly translated from Vishnath Chakravarti Thakura's commentary. And this is what Srila Prabhupada said struck him very deeply. So the same thing applies in Karma Yoga, and it also applies in Bhakti Yoga. So it's very relevant to us. So we'll carry on from here tomorrow. Any comment or question, Madhuji? Sorry? Gyan, yes, knowledge. Well, Jnana Yoga really is a practice which is based on that knowledge. Jnana Yoga traditionally means to realize the nature of the soul, or Brahman. So, These are like the fundamental principles of the knowledge on which the practices of Jnana Yoga are based. Jnana Yoga generally means mental speculation on these types of subjects. What is the soul? How is the soul different from the body? Like that. He hasn't talked of any practice. It's just the knowledge as such which he's been giving. So it's not Jnana Yoga as such, but it's just that Jnana of the knowledge of the soul.
You mentioned that it constantly performs the prescribed duty.
Yeah.
Just by that force, you would have been
heaven. That's what Krishna says, yeah. Yeah. If they actually perform their, what is really their prescribed duty according to Varnara and Ashram, then they can be elevated to heaven. That's the whole idea of, I mean, that's one important idea in Vedic society. Because that duty will also involve different religious practices also. That's what Krishna has been saying. One last point.
This term Vyavasthita is what
you mean.
What's the breakdown of Vyavasthita? Do you know
what? No. No, I don't know. Ask Sakshi Narayan.
Can you get a short?
Sorry?
I think I can get a short question.
All right.
That means, I don't know, could you... I don't know if I correctly understand. This section from 31 to 38 is Karma Kanda.
Right.
Sakama Karma Yoga is only one verse, 38.
Yeah.
And next is description Nishkama.
Nishkam Karma Yoga, yeah. That's the basic idea, yeah. So tonight, please, I hope you read through chapter 2 last night or yesterday. If you didn't, please do. Because from now on, it's a little subtle. From here to the end of the chapter, it's definitely a little bit complicated. Not too complicated, but a bit. So it would help if you were just a little conversant with it for tomorrow. And then do read about the yoga ladder in your overview book, page 55 and 56. Srila Prabhupada ki.